You are listening to the IFH Podcast Network. For more amazing filmmaking and screenwriting podcasts, just go to ifhpodcastnetwork.com.
Welcome to the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, episode number 434. The enemy of art is the absence of limitations. Orson Welles.
Broadcasting from the back alley in Hollywood, it's the Indie Film Hustle Podcast, where we show you how to survive and thrive as an indie filmmaker in the jungles of the film biz. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Indie Film Hustle Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari.
Today's show is sponsored by Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, how to turn your independent film into a profitable business. It's harder today than ever before for independent filmmakers to make money with their films, from predatory film distributors ripping them off to huckster film aggregators who prey upon them. The odds are stacked against the indie filmmaker. The old distribution model of making money with your film is broken, and there needs to be a change. The future of independent filmmaking is the entrepreneurial filmmaker or the filmtrepreneur. In Rise of the Filmtrepreneur, I break down how to actually make money with your film projects and show you how to turn your indie film into a profitable business. With case studies examining successes and failures, this book shows you the step-by-step method to turn your passion into a profitable career. If you're making a feature film, series, or any other kind of video content, the Filmtrepreneur method will set you up for success. The book is available in paperback, ebook, and of course, audiobook. If you want to order it, just head over to www.filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. And today's show is also sponsored by the Heart Chart Screenwriting Masterclass, taught by legendary screenwriter James V. Hart, the writer of Bram Stoker's Dracula, Hook, and Contact, to name a few. His unique story mapping system will teach you how to get your script ready for production and the marketplace. To gain instant access, head over to bulletproofscreenwriting.tv/heart chart. That's H-A-R-T chart. Now, guys, today on the show, we have writer, director, editor, producer, actor, and author, Josh Folan. Now, Josh is a 15-year veteran in the independent filmmaking game. And he decided to sit down and write a book to share his misadventures, what he has learned, and all the different ways that he's put together multiple films over the years. His book is called Still Filmmaking the Hard Way. And Josh walks you through the painstaking step-by-step process of making three sub-$250K budgeted films, while explaining, scrutinizing, and contrasting the experience in a voice intended to entertain and not lecture. I had a ball talking to Josh, and I can't wait to share this episode with you. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Josh Folan. I'd like to welcome to the show Josh Folan, man. How you doing, Josh?
Good, man. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thanks for being on the show, brother. I'm a fan of your book, Still Filmmaking the Hard Way. I feel that we might have been cut from the same cloth a bit, because you're as jaded and have as much shrapnel as I do, probably, in this business.
I have my share for sure. I don't know. It's all relative, but I certainly have my share.
Yeah. You're battle hardened, sir, as they say. Yeah. You are battle hardened. So I did
11 years in, or 13 years in NYC, and then two more in LA now. So 15 years on those, in those two places doing this shit. Yeah.
You've got some scars. Got some scars. Yeah. Before we get started, man, how did you get into the business?
My background's fine. I went to school for finance, Ohio State, and worked briefly in that before moving out to New York for in front of the camera stuff. Mm-hmm. And I was there a couple of months, actually. I booked something for Comedy Central, kind of sent me down the acting path, took some classes at William Esper Studios and some on-camera stuff, got a job on one of the soaps, and working on there. I was on there for like 3 years on my children on ABC. So. And it was a reoccurring U5 day player thing. It wasn't a contract role or anything, but it was a nice first real job for sure. And while I was on that show, another guy and I started producing theater with the actual important soap stars. They sell tickets and have fans that are pretty rabid. So we did okay with that. And towards the tail end of my run on that show, I did some really bad horror film, six kids locked in a house kind of thing. And the other male lead and I had a similar horror thriller kind of scripts. And in our naivety, we decided to go out and try to raise financing for the two of them at once, as if having two products to sell
obviously,
to financiers.
Because it's easier. It's much easier to get money for two projects, right?
Well, that actually would have been maybe smarter. We were thinking that just like having two options, like pick one, like they're, you know, apples and oranges or something.
And did you think that at any moment it was going to just like when should the money drop? It should be dropping.
Oh, of course. You know, I don't know. I honestly, it's so long ago. And I tend to be I wouldn't say glass half empty, but the glass is exactly 50%.
Right.
So I don't expect great things to happen. I anticipate hearing my nose, but there's certainly no way you can anticipate the number and the type of nose you're going to hear before you've tried to raise financing for a film, for sure, especially with no experience. Like, you know, it's like, why in God's name would anyone give you money to make a movie until you've shown you can do that activity and bring it to fruition? You know what I mean? Like, why would anyone do that? So yeah, it's not easy to start. And but, certainly we had our difficulties, but
isn't it insane that our business is the, I mean, you don't hear someone going, I'm going to go build a house. I need you to give me $400,000. I'm going to go, I've never built a house ever. But I've seen HGTV. And I feel strongly that I have a vision and I think we can do it.
I keep an Evernote running with everything they say on the shows. I thought we should be set.
but that's kind of the insanity of filmmakers in general. Like I'm guilty of it. You obviously were guilty of it. There's no way
you get to that first step, that first rung on the ladder without that blind leap of faith and just bumping your head into a wall until it happens, you know?
And then every once in a while, that guy or that gal gets the $1 million because I've worked on those projects.
Sure.
And some dumb money said, hey, I want to invest in this kid. Let's go for it. And I've been in those projects and you just see this. Rarely does it come out okay. I mean, you're talking about minuscule.
Yep.
Just even into
my career, the projects that I'm covering in the book here, I mean, that we shot in 2015, 17, and 18. Yeah. And that's, you know, over 6 years into my career on the first one there. So I've been doing it for a while and done enough films to not be sure. Considered like I have no idea what the hell I'm doing. And right. Even in those cases, the money came to every one of them in like random ass, unexpected ways that were almost exclusively a product or a function of just the cast it until something bites. And that's, you know, you got to collect your nose. You have to collect your nose. It's as simple as that. And that makes the yes that much better, but understand that you're going to be collecting a lot of those and, you know, you just never know what the yes is going to be. So expect no's.
Expect those and expect to start collecting as many of them as possible, because the more you collect, the closer you are to someone saying yes.
Precisely.
And it's
by law of averages.
Yeah, by law of averages. And it could take not only – it's not going to take 6 months. It could take 3 or 4 years sometimes.
Sure.
Especially when you're starting out and don't have a track record. Now when you are, so you're going to start your movie. So let's say there's filmmakers listening right now that, okay, we have this movie. We want to try to go raise money. Should you define the audience for that film prior to the development of it? Even like, should you know who you're going to sell this to?
I think, you know, it never hurts. It's never bad to do the work. It's never a bad plan. I think with smaller projects, you know, that first time, like we made God only knows how many pages it was, business plan with all these sales projections where you're depending on completely unfounded comparison projects.
Was this a horror film?
In your mind at the time.
It was a horror film?
Well, my very first film was, you know, it's a love story. It happens to happen in a really fucked up, dark place between a serial killer and a prostitute. It was my very first film. So we were able to market it. As
a horror. So in the projections, did you use Blair Witch?
We probably did. I honestly don't even remember. Like, we're talking. I'm sure we did.
Everyone uses Blair Witch, Paranormal Activity, like the biggest unicorns in the last three decades.
Exactly. Unicorn is a great word for it. Yeah. And, you know, so I mean, yeah. And honestly, it's just, it doesn't, it's not bad to know that stuff. So when you have the conversations, you have some sort of at least basis. You know, I think it's more important, I find, when talking with investors to be wildly, especially going through it now a number of times, to be wildly transparent, because it's actually more, I think, attention garnering to have a conversation with someone who has money, particularly if they're someone who does any investing with regularity at all, to hear someone sit down and the first thing they say is, you need to be okay with losing this money. that's something that they don't hear, because if people are, you know, people are trying to be sold or who are being sold things all the time, don't hear that maybe ever, but let alone as the first thing said in a conversation. So in one aspect, it just gets attention and gets someone to listen to you. Maybe hears this type of thing all the time, but it's also honest. And if you want to create any sort of longevity in this career, in this line of work as a producer, like you don't, especially someone with money, you don't want to burn that bridge. So if you walk into it being completely transparent about what the realistic side of this business and find people who want to invest in your projects for a reason other than the independent film business is about, unfortunately, I don't think, in my opinion, you know, in the ultra low budget sector, I'm saying, you know, those projections mean more when more money is at stake, when
bigger stars are at play.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
You can use things that actually can be quantified, because you can't quantify so many aspects of these very small projects, you know, sub 250K projects. You can't quantify these things with any realistic metric. So trying to qualify them with investors and the way you put the projects together in some sort of ultra quantifiable way is completely unrealistic. And there has to be a reason to do it.
The only way I can even think of doing that is if you have certain cast involved, and then you can use their former
– sure.
Former projections of what they've made on other films in similar genres, and you can go, look, you're not going to get Nicolas Cage in that movie, but let's say you get Michael Madsen or Danny Trejo, and in that world, and you've paid him for a day to come out and shoot out the scenes,
and these are quantifiable things in the foreign sales market, sure, but I think even that is kind of
it's not
a really small project. It's super unrealistic, you know.
Really, no, it isn't. It's something. It's something you might be able to hang your hat on, but it's not something that it's.
Especially if you're working, like I like to make, you know, festival targeted, kind of duplex, clever people in rooms talking kind of movies that have something to say. It's even more undefinable there. If you move into, you know, Danny Trejo are working in these genre movies, these things that do have a quantifiable foreign marketplace for them, where that could be. Can be determined, but you know, I mean, I talk to sales agents about some of these movies, dramas and stuff, and they're like, it's execution based. That's what they call it, execution based. So it means they're not going to give you shit right now. If you bring me a good movie and it has something I can sell after you do it, let's talk.
Maybe.
But in the development stages, they have no value realistically. You know what I mean?
So, and I noticed that you keep your budgets low, under 250. Now, a lot of filmmakers listening will say, but Josh, I can't make my movie for less than $1 million. I mean, I just can't. I need $2.5 million to make this film. I have to have this to make it. I've been preaching from the top of the mountain for such a long time. Like, if you can make your movie for 15 grand and it looks good and you can sell it for 30, you are in a business.
Right.
You're not going to live off that. You can make 10 of those.
If you want that to be your mantra, then by all means have it. Like, you know, I'm not going to – that's – you know, we talked about this, just kind of the film industry is such a – who the hell – you know, you just don't know what's going to happen. And, you know, there's – things do shoot to the moon sometimes. And, like, I'm not going to tell anyone what they're doing is wrong. Like, if that's your thing and you think you can do it that way and you – whether you do or don't have a plan to get there, you know, like, I'm not going to tell you not to do it. I will tell you realistically, someone who, and that's what the, you know, the book is like, these aren't the roadmaps to make your movie. These are three things I did step by step, and that's how I did it. Like, I hope you can learn from that. I can't tell you it's transferable. Every film project is its own unique problem set. Good luck with it. You know, like, all you can do is educate yourself as much as possible and bump into the shit you have to bump into on the way to the finish line and hope you get there. But, you know, it's certainly, if you are more realistic about putting together a project, especially if you don't have a lot of experience where you don't have a track record that is quantifiable, like, good luck. But it's a whole lot easier if you meter yourself and come up with an idea that can be done at an executable amount of money that you can convince whoever you have to convince around you to finance it, that either you can make their money back if that is their core reasoning for investing in your project, right. You know, and that's something you have to determine, feel out, and be responsible and honest about when you're having those conversations. Or if you find someone who's willing to invest in you or wants to invest in art, or, you know, in the case of Ask for Jane, that's a movie that has a borderline documentary component to it, or social justice component to it, that has, you know, our financing came to that because it had something to say about something that mattered to the women who paid for it. And, you know, they want to make their money back. Of course, no one wants to lose money unless you're, I don't know. I shouldn't say that. Who knows?
But. I've met a couple of those guys. They're like, yeah, I just want to go out. Can I just come on set?
It's good for my tax break. It's good for my
tax. It's a good tax break. I just want to come on set. I want to hang out with the actors, and I want to do the red carpet and maybe go to a festival or two. This is why I'm giving you $200,000. That happens,
you know.
It happens.
And that's still not wanting to lose money, but it's not the reason they're investing in it. Exactly.
Correct.
And you know, yeah. And Ask for Jane was absolutely an example of that. They wanted to tell this story about a group of women who advocated for women's reproductive rights in a time when they weren't being properly advocated for or being properly respected by a whole lot of people. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So that's why we got to make that movie, because we found someone who cared about what the movie meant, not because we were trying to create a commercial product that was going to be financially viable in the long run. You know what I mean? Hopefully we can make it happen that way in the long run, but who knows, you know?
But you have a niche audience with that. I mean, you have and that's not even a small niche. It's a fairly large niche.
Especially right now. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Especially right now. So it is a timely film. There's an audience for that film. And I think
there has been. We did incredibly well at festivals. And,
oh, I'm sure. You know, that's a festival, really, darling. I was like, oh, absolutely. Please, this is perfect.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the funny thing is, you know, I came onto that after the script stage for the most part. We dealt with it a little right before we shot. But basically that script was done when I came on board as a producer. And Kate and Rachel, the women who, you know, were the catalyst for putting that script together. You know, when they started writing, it was pre-election. They had no idea that it was going to become that. And that's a perfect example. That's another filmmaking lesson too. Like the whole idea, when you talk to these sales agents, they'll tell you this thing is hot right now. Religious faith films are, you know, faith films are earning money right now. Why don't you try to do one of those? And I can help you put that together. Da, 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 da. And you can chase that. But what are the odds that the thing that is working right now, 3 years from now, 2 years from now, when you get this whole thing to the finish line and it's ready to come out, it's still going to be relevant. It's highly unlikely. So you're much better served, in my opinion, making the films that you want to watch. That's what I make. I make movies that I would want to watch, and whatever happens, happens. At least I can stand by knowing that that's the core value of it. You know, that's the core purpose of this, and whatever happens, I have to accept it. But if you chase those things and it goes wrong, like, that's got to be just soul crushing. To do something that you hate.
Oh, trust
don't
me.
Care about.
Then- oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I've been there. I had a project that was floating around around town. We had talent attached. We had all this stuff, taking meetings left and right. And it was of the moment, which is funny, because of the moment, it was a little bit ahead of its time. It was like maybe 2-3 years ahead of its time. But it was still kind of like that whole vibe of what was going on, this action movie I was doing. And then it was just like, oh, nobody wants a female lead action star. Like, that's – we can't.
Which you can't get a movie made unless you have one now. So
yeah, I mean, you can't do that. There's no box office star. So there was that whole thing. And then now it's come back into vogue. You just don't know. I mean, look, when Passion of the Christ came out, first of all, nobody saw that one coming. And then all of a sudden faith-based films started popping up everywhere because, like, oh, there's a market here. Let's make some money. And that's what happened. So you just can't, you've never know. Now, what are a few things you wish you would have known before making your first film?
I took a project. This is a short film with a first time film. And like when talking to them about whether or not it was a fit on both sides of the thing, they were asking kind of a similar question to that. Like, what do we need to know that we don't know? And I'm like, the biggest thing probably you should know is that you need to accept what you don't know and stop trying to fix it. Like, don't try to anticipate. Like, shit's going to happen. It's going to go. Days are going to go awry. Things aren't going to go according to plan. And the biggest thing you need to do is understand that you need to be open to whatever those constraints end up being and be adaptable. And, like, you know, you can – I am a wildly over-the-top, organized, preparation mind individual, contingencies for contingencies, et cetera, et cetera. So you can do all that. And again, just like we were talking about with the underlying business plan to a project, you should do all that work so you know what it is, know what the skeleton of whatever you're doing is, but understand that when you get there on the day of, that all goes out the window, just like a shot list. Like, time might run out. You know, we might not be able to get that thing. We lose light. This goes wrong. This shoot right now for, you know, there's a million things that can go wrong. So have a plan, but understand that that plan is probably going to be useless on the day of, and understand that you have to be able to adapt to whatever the situation is. And there's no preparation for that other than being open-minded. You know what I mean?
Right. And I noticed that too, because when I've been on set with directors, I always find that the directors who cannot pivot and adjust and roll with the punches, they crumble. Because they're like, but I need the sun to stop moving. I'm like, well, dude, that's just not the way the world works. Yep. They're rigid. If you're rigid in the filmmaking process, you're dead. If Spielberg and Nolan have to worry about the sun, so do you. I mean, now,
right? Yeah, yeah.
And now, yeah, now, I mean, now, not as much with the virtual production of The Mandalorian, where you could have a sunset for 12 hours.
Sure. Yeah, it makes something. But in even that case, though, you have to spend an exorbitant amount of money to facilitate that sort of.
And you still have 12 hours. You still only have 12 hours in the day to get what you need. So right, yep. I'm sorry.
Right. Yep. No, yeah, I mentioned that we're going through Ask for Jane. Rachel Carey, the director of that, just, you know, first time feature. She'd done a pilot and a couple smaller projects prior to. But like, I just couldn't, you know, it's, you can say these things and they might read them in books before they get on set, but you don't know how amenable someone's going to be. So you get there on the day of and you see, how can they actually deal with it? Can they solve that problem with a million people around them asking them questions, et cetera, and all that pressure being on them. And she just did an amazing job of, like, whatever, you know, we had, you know, we shot that a period piece, a late 60s period piece with 72 locations, like I'm 70 something locations. Wow. Or sorry, 50 something locations, 74 speaking roles, 24 shoot days, with, you know, $250,000.
Yeah, that was under 250?
Yeah.
Oh, period. Man, yeah. that's impressive.
Know, period cars. I mean, a lot of it, we to her credit too, writing the script, she did a good job of keeping things internal and, you know, contained environments that we could properly dressed, at least to some degree or another, to maintain that. We obviously weren't getting any sweeping street shots or anything like that with line with period cars. We had a few period cars, and those are their own pain in the ass and very expensive. but you know, they were mitigated to some degree. But yeah, I mean, you know, whatever with all those variables, whatever the hell came up, she was able to just go, okay, well, what are our options? You know, and like, that's, as a producer, that is like that's the dream director thing to come out of their mouth. It's like, what are our options? Let me choose one, you know, as opposed to freaking out and know those options don't work, you know, right. Which is not the way to approach this stuff, because you can't, it's of no benefit to freak out. We're not going to get to the finish line if you freak out. You know what I mean?
And I find that a lot of times when you have those limitations, the magic shows up that would never have shown up before. If you would have done it as you planned, it's never as good as what happened on the day, because this actor, this camera, this lighting, this scenario, this magic, you've got to be there ready to capture the lightning in the bottle and not try to control everything unless you're Kubrick or Fincher. And then that's fine. And that's their process. And even then, I'm sure there's magic that happens on the day.
Yeah. That's how you get there. Being that creative, like, you know, keeping that muscle going and exercising it, as trite as that may sound, like, that is the way you get good at this stuff, is to learn how to adapt and deal with whatever comes up. A canned story I've told probably a million times about that very first feature, All God's Creatures. We had this movie theater scene, and we wanted a claw machine in a movie theater lobby, and that was, like, it was very important that that happened in a movie theater lobby, because they're going to go see a movie after. It was so important to me as the writer and to us, everyone on the project. And, you know, we looked all over. I was still in New York at the time. We looked all over finding a claw machine in a movie theater lobby that allowed us to shoot there for our literally borderline zero location budget, just not happening. Of course, we end up, I lived on 100, and I don't know how familiar you are with New York, but I lived up in Spanish Harlem at the time. And right in the corner, I lived on 110th and first, between first and second Avenue. And on 110th and second Avenue, there was a bodega with a claw machine outside that I walked by every day in pre-production while we were looking for this location. And we couldn't find it. And I was walking by the bodega one day, and I was like, we're making this gritty love story, fucked up love story between these two dark people like a serial killer and a prostitute in New York City, it is 100% in line with what we're trying to do here for this scene to happen in this grimy outside some grimy bodega as opposed to in this beautifully lit, pretty movie theater lobby. Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. And like I go in there and talk the bodega guy into it in like 5 minutes and we have a solution. And it ended up catering to what the overall aesthetic of the film was infinitely more so than if we had got the thing we thought we needed. You know what I mean? And that is a product of problem solving that ended up, yeah, exactly that, ended up serving what our end goal really was, and we didn't even know it.
So gotta like, be, yeah, gotta have that, yeah, exactly, and have those antennas open for when that happens. You gotta be open to it, because a lot of times filmmakers are just like this, and they're closed off, and they're like, this is my vision, and my vision that I've been with for 6 months, a year with this script, this is the only way it can be. Yeah.
I sat in that room all alone and I had it exactly. It's exactly.
It has to be a claw machine in a movie theater. And the carpet needs to be red. And that's the stupidity that we do as filmmakers. I did that too. Like, we all did that. Like, oh, it has to be this and it has to be that. But as you get older and you do more of these things, you just kind of go, does it have to be red? I think. No. What color do we have? Do we have blue? Blue, fine. Let's move on.
It's not other industries though. Like, you know, that's a perfect example. Like, what other industry would you be, you know, that rigid about every aspect of what, you know, what you're trying to do professionally? Like, it's such a weird business in that regard.
Architecture and construction. I mean, essentially, you can't really freeball a whole lot. Once the construction's going on, like, hey, you know what? I thought I wanted to move the wall over there. Like, that's. That's one of the businesses, some,
but it's not the norm.
It's definitely not the norm. And also surgery. I would rather not my surgeon not kind of like, you know.
I don't know, man. I got some friends that work in medical device sales and stuff, and I've heard some crazy stories.
I'm sure. Now, one thing that that a lot of filmmakers don't even think about, and it's not talked about a lot, is how can a production protect themselves legally before going into production, in production, and post-production? Like, what are some tips on how to protect themselves legally, you know, basic stuff?
We'll be right back after a word from our sponsor. And now, back to the show.
For small budget projects, the best answer to that is get a good friend that's a lawyer.
Right, of course.
The best answer, because it's tough to find good legal advice inexpensively, for sure. Do your homework. There's enough at this point. There's no such thing, I think, in 2020. One of the beautiful things about working in film now as opposed to what it would have been like pre-internet days, which I don't even know, most of the people listening to this probably can't even conceive that, but you know, when I was first getting started, it was right kind of at the infancy stage. And I was like, some of the things we had to do, location scouting, try and find some of the things that we needed, some of our production variables, like without the internet. I don't know how that ever happened without the internet, to be honest with you. But
I remember. I'm old enough, sir. Yeah? I remember. Oh, yeah. I'm a bit older than you.
Until my late 20s, so I didn't.
I remember film.
Fucking difficult.
I remember film. I remember having to go into a dark bag and change film mags. And you only had 10 minutes at a time. It was incredible time. It was insane.
It was a barbaric time
where sometimes the PA would open up the can and ruin the last 10 minutes of footage and you lost 6 hours. I've been there too. Oh yes, it was a joyous time.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyways, the point would be that there's no such thing as not knowing how to do something anymore, kind of. You can find an answer or someone who has the answer anywhere, you know what I mean, or about anything really for the most part. And asking, honestly, if you can't find it on your own, I have found, whether it be reaching out to filmmakers about, you know, distribution companies they've worked with or whatever it might be, filmmakers, especially in the independent sector, are very open to having conversations and helping, being helpful. And like, I wildly advocate for that, because I think all of our jobs and lives would be much easier if we were more transparent, more helpful, et cetera, et cetera. But I don't think there's any shortage of that necessarily. And if you just do the work to ask people who, and you have to do the work to know who has walked whatever that path is that you want to know about, whether it be a certain legal question or a certain production question or whatever it might be. But reaching out to those people and asking, how the hell did you do this? Like, if someone solved some wildly difficult problem, they're probably going to be all too excited to tout and talk about how they accomplished this very difficult thing. So asking questions and doing the research, whatever it might be it legal things or otherwise, is always the answer. If you don't have that lawyer, that free lawyer friend, you know, to just lean on for an easy answer.
We're going to talk next about my favorite part of the entire production process, which is distribution. I know you told me that you've been listening to the podcast for a while and you heard the whole distributor thing and how that whole thing went down. And you obviously have a lot of experience distributing your own films, either self or with a traditional distributor. Can you tell a little bit of story of what happened to which film was it that went through traditional? 22. Okay. So that went through traditional distribution.
And Ask for Jane both did, but the better story has played out with Catch-22.
So please enlighten the audience, sir.
Right. So Catch-22, we shot that in 2015, did the festival thing for most of 2016. At the tail end of 2016, the funny thing about distribution in the independent sector is you're not, unless you have some film, you know, playing some big boy table festival, you're not good. These offers don't happen in a vacuum. They don't all come to you at once where you can weigh them, the pros and cons of each right alongside each other. That's not how it works. You have to get good at not necessarily good at, but understand whatever your goals might be, whether they're fiscal or, you know, however you want it to be released. If the company's going to facilitate and be able to do that the way you want it, be able to gauge what you're being told by these companies and decide whether or not it meets your expectations slash hope for what the distribution of your project will be. And in our case, we had a bunch come to us over the course of that festival run. And towards the tail end of it, we had one come in that actually had an MG, and it was a company I liked what the guy in charge had to say to us. The acquisitions guy was 108 Media up in Toronto, and we ended up going with them. And that was in, I want to say, October. We signed the deal with – we had a target street date of, I believe it was January 17th of 2017. So nice round numbers there. Mm-hmm. And it came out, and they did all – everything they said they were going to do as far as the digital release goes. There was no theatrical component to that. So it was just hitting all the platforms. And the way the MG was structured on the project, we were supposed to – it was going to be due, I believe it was 2 weeks after the street date. Or something like that, and then XYZ maybe 2 months after said street date, the second half of the payment was due, and the whatever the window was or the date comes on that first payment comes and goes. We don't have our check yet. I email and I'm like, hey guys, what's up?
How you guys doing? Hey, what's going on over there?
and I was still, it was still early enough in my career, and I hadn't had enough bad things happening to me in the distribution realm where I didn't just expect the apocalypse. You know what I mean? Oh. So I was, I hadn't
come online yet, sir. I hadn't come online yet, sir. If not, you would have been better prepared.
Right. Yeah. It's funny. My very first film, we ended up getting a deal too, also a decent little MG, and they, they actually did all right, I would say, in the long run. They did some foreign stuff that we couldn't have facilitated on our own, but they were very, very old, old guard minded. They were always talking to us about DVDs and shit, even into like 2015, 2016. And I was like, why are you saying these words to me? Like, these words mean nothing.
Right.
Why are we not talking about every digital platform on the planet? So there were, that ended up going its own awry way too, but not nearly as bad as this one did. So anyways, that day comes and goes. I email them like, what's up? We get into this long, drawn out exchange. And in the interest of transparency, in the book, like, I have a by email recounting of the exchange. Like, again, completely transparent. It's a beautiful thing, really. If you like, email vitriol, I recommend checking out that part of it, sure, if nothing else. So 2 month. It's a 2 month back and forth with their acquisitions person, their operations person, and they're kind of, to their credit, they were always very nice and they were either lying, albeit nicely, or they were bordering on insolvency. And in either case, I was like, this mm-hmm. that's not a company I want my film with for what we were, I think the deal was for 7 years, five or 7 years. So we, you know, they were fairly reasonable on the term, which you can't always get. But either way, I didn't, you know, I couldn't have our film. It wouldn't be responsible for me as the producer to our investors to keep our film in bed with a company that is going to either be lying or about to fold, you know. Mm-hmm. So like mm-hmm. it came down to me, you know, I Googling, talking about your legal problems. I Googled, I found a letter, distribution agreement termination letter that I assuaged.
You paid homage to.
to our needs. And, you know, to their credit, they were actually they tried to talk me out of it a couple of times right there towards the end of it, but they eventually relinquished rights. We ended up getting the first half of the payment of the MG. It was $7,500, and they sent us the first $3,750 in between these two, in that first 2 week window and me sending the letter. I did get the check. It comes in an envelope. There are two checks in the envelope. One is for $1,875. Another is for $1,875. And at first I opened the envelope and I'm like, that's kind of weird. Why is it two checks? And then as I go to the bank, I get to the ATM to deposit them, and I see one is post-dated. So one was dated for
– never, never a good sign.
Oh, yeah. And the other one is post-dated for 2 weeks out or something. And, I mean, you know, that's one of the fun parts of the email exchange. I'm like, guys, you got to be kidding me. Like, you know, I wait for way longer than I'm supposed to get the checks at all, and then one of them's post-dated? Like, are you out of your mind? You know,
so
what is the explanation here?
So everyone listening, if you get a check that's post-dated and it's $1,875, that's generally not a good sign that your distributor's having problems paying you $1,800. It's a red flag. It's a red flag.
To put it mildly, yeah.
So continue, sir.
So yeah, so you know, I sent the letter. We ended up getting to keep that money. They didn't even ask for that back, which is, you know, not bad. For a couple of months, I guess, of anguish, through three months or so of anguish, it created the problem of course, we have to, and they were rather expedient about that too. Again, like it's surprising for something that went so awry. Like I don't have, it could have went a lot worse just as far as the personal side of it went. The exchanges could have been a lot meaner, I suppose, for a deal going this wrong. But yeah, they relinquish the rights and they have to get it off all the platforms. And then that's not always the cleanest of processes.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, so then getting them relisted, in some cases you can't even relist with some platforms. And that was part of their, like, that was one of the angles they took with trying to talk me out of it. They're like, yeah, I think it was iTunes and maybe Hulu. They were saying, and then, you know, it wasn't even on Hulu at the time, but like we're talking to them at least. But they were saying that, you know, there's some platforms you can't even get back on. I'm like, yeah, well, that's, you know, what's like 10% of, like, or rather 100% of nothing is a lot less than 10% of something, you know what I mean? So like,
right.
You're like, that's,
yeah. What was it? What was the deal? Was it 25, 75, 20, 80, 30, 70, 60, 40?
That was 70, 30. I'm pretty sure was the split. Yeah, and our marketing cap, might've been, that's, it's all in the book. I'd have to look at it to remember. We're talking, you know, a few years ago, but yeah, I mean, you know, I had done all my homework as far as keeping the main deal points. And that's something I talk extensively about the book too, understanding what those major deal points are. We didn't have a performance clause like we talked about before we jumped on. Like that's a really good thing to talk about these days that I would certainly, particularly if they want some sort of term that's anything more than a half decade, honestly, I would want some sort of performance clause at this point because there's just no reason to sign that, unless there's an exorbitant MG, of course, that makes it.
And if there is an exorbitant MG, you can almost guarantee that that's the only money you'll ever see.
For sure. Yeah. The idea of recouping it all, for sure. Yeah.
There's no way you'll ever. If you get a $200,000 upfront MG in today's marketplace,
the accounting is not going to go in your favor going forward.
I hate to tell you. I hate to tell you, but that's just not going to work out. And I was telling you this story, and I'll tell you, I'll say it now, the story of a filmmaker friend of mine who I was consulting that was a little too informed for this big distributor who shall remain nameless, but that we all know, and that is, you know, that throws up 40 movies a month, if not more, and they were offering him an MG, and it was this whole deal, and I kept telling him, well, let's push them, let's see how far we can get with them, and the second he asked for a performance clause, they said, you know what, we're just going to pass on this. After like wooing him and wanting it and promising him the world and everything. But the second he asked for a performance clause, they're like, uh-oh, abort, abort. This guy knows too much. Abort, abort. And it's not – for them, it's not worth the hassle to deal with an educated producer. Unless they have a former relationship, then that's already kind of established with a sales agent or a producer. But with the new guys, like, oh, no, this guy knows way too much. He's going to ask way too many questions. Yep. I don't want to deal with him. Next.
For those companies that where their business is structured around doing that kind of business and exploiting the undereducated and overly hopeful filmmaker. Yeah. And that, you know, that's probably the biggest soapbox thing with the book is that it's, you know, it sucks that it exists, but it's our job as the filmmakers to make it go away. And if we don't support it, if we don't let them take our films just because we think having their name on the project as a distributor is going to help our careers down the line, because these companies that operate this way and check off any of these red flags that I list off very explicitly, like if they hit any of those things, everyone in the industry knows it. You're not impressing anyone by having a film with a company that is known for operating like this. It doesn't give your film a badge of honor. It doesn't give your career a badge of honor. There is no advantage to giving away, again, you know, if you're never going to see a dime back just because
Disney is – because Disney's distributing your movie, which they wouldn't distribute an indie. But if Disney is distributing your movie, like I got distributed by Disney, I'm like, yeah, but you're broke.
Yeah. It's just not – it just doesn't – it's sad how many filmmakers were – that's not the important thing. I, you know, there's a close friend of mine – sorry, go ahead.
No, I wanted to say – and tell me your story about your close friend. Go ahead.
Yeah, a close friend of mine that produced the project. It was his first feature, and he ended up going with the very company that we're discussing, but won't say the name of. And it was important to him, that exact thing, to have this film, his first, be one that was released and like this. In the public eye, a legitimate way, as opposed to the sad, lonely place of self-distribution. And, you know, it harks to what's important to you. And like, again, I'm not – he's a close friend of mine, and I'm not – like that was his set of goals. And like, even as the producer on the project, you know, it's his project. I'm just helping him make it happen. And like that understanding what your goals are with the project – And being able to look at these distribution offers in that light and make it a responsible decision that achieves whatever those goals were that you set for yourself is the important thing. Like if that is what your goal is, then fine. I told him numerous times, I'm like, listen, you will never see a dime in this deal. It will never happen. Like understand that if you're going to take it. And he understood it and decided to do it anyways. And like, you know, you have to just accept that because that was important to him. But I want to change that. I want us to stop viewing that as a positive thing.
I want to kind of dig into this a little bit because I think it's something that's definitely not talked about, and I feel it's a sickness that filmmakers have, and it is, and I get it, especially when you know, there's two reasons I think this happens. One, ego. You just want to say that you were distributed by X company, you know, like, hey, I want to have my film. Like everybody wants to have their film at A24. Like that's as an independent, like we all want. They're the Sundance of distribution. And they release
a deal like this from a company like that. That's kind of the point, you know. You don't get deals like that from Orchard. They release, doesn't ask you to foot their operating costs.
Right, exactly. So these kind of distribution companies that are kind of like elevated art house kind of brands, you want to just get with one of those, and you don't care how abusive or you know the advantage you're being taken, all the money that they're going to steal or anything. You don't care because you just want to say that you directed a movie that was distributed by them, which is insanity, as opposed to like, you self-distributed. I'm sorry about that.
It's not a sad, lonely place. I hate that. That's exactly how we think
because
of it.
First of all, that's an image that the industry has perpetrated. So that's a marketing ploy by the distribution side. Like, you don't want to self-distribute. You'll never make a dime. You need us. You need us to make it. And you know what? Depending on – it's a per-project basis. If you've got a $5 million movie, self-distribution is a tough model to play. It's a tough model to play. If you got a million-plus dollar movie, self-distribution is not impossible, but you got to hit every target exactly. So that's why those budgets lower the budget, the better chance you have of recouping and being profitable in your films. So there is a place for good quality partnerships with traditional distributors. Honest, which is, it's an oxymoron, I know, but it's like military intelligence. It just doesn't, jumbo shrimp. It just doesn't. but if you can partner with someone like that, and then also carve out some rights for yourself and maybe create ancillary products, and you have something that you could build up. Like, I don't think there's going to be a lot of, you know, ask for Jane, you know, lunchboxes.
Action figures.
Yeah. So it depends. It depends on the project. But if the certain projects have that, it's absolutely doable. But self-distribution, I'd rather be, and I have been, my films have been, you know, I've self-distributed a lot of my films. I'd rather be in positive rich off of my movie and not distribute to one of these guys, and instead of being broke and have the ego trip of, oh, I was distributed by X film, X distributor. Right. And I want I want everyone out there to listen to and hear that. And I think you and I are both very passionate about that. Go ahead.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's not even a matter of like, yes, it is harder and it is more work to self-distribute. And that's why so many filmmakers are adverse to it, because they just want to get onto their next film. And that's we've all heard that whole component of it a million times. But even if, you know, there's an excerpt from the book that's up from this whole soapbox section about distribution and fucking getting rid of these companies that are preying on filmmakers that don't know any better. Like, there's the math problem example in there. The good deal only makes $1,000, and like, that sounds terrible. Unless you made your film for less than $1,000, which is not a terrible decision, but whatever it is, like it's 10% of something is better than 100% of nothing. It's a very simple thing. And like, the idea that we have to, you know, we already made the point. I don't know. We've made the point.
Yeah, I mean, the whole process of giving away your film because you're exhausted or you're not educated. Well, that's in all honesty, that's a failure on you as a film producer, as a filmmaker and as a producer. You need to educate yourself on this process. And there's no excuse. There's just no excuse. You know what the latest lenses are. You know that the Blackmagic just came out with a 12K camera. Fantastic. That's great. But you know what? That doesn't matter. The story matters. The story and the creative process is extremely important in this process. There's no doubt about it. But just as important, if not a bit more important sometimes, is the distribution and the business side of it. Because without that, you can't make the art. And that's what I've been yelling at the top of my lungs for so much. And I know what the core lessons of your book is you got to understand the business. And it's not sexy. It's not sexy. It's not the sexy part of it.
It depends, man.
Well, I love it.
Finance. I enjoy the pretty spreadsheet, Alex. And if you're not one of those people, you should partner up with someone who is.
Correct. And that's another thing you should absolutely do without question. So that was your traditional distribution. So how did you do the self-distribution on the other project?
So yeah, Love is Dead, we self-distributed, and that was something, you know, walking into it. So Love is Dead is an adaptation of a stage play that a buddy of mine wrote, and it's, you know, a crazy, crazy dark comedy about every possible horrible aspect of the human condition. And, you know, it's based on a stage play.
It's a feel good film.
Yeah. Yeah. Disney type stuff. So yeah, I mean, you know, we were looking at the project initially. He sends it to me even before he's put it up as a play. And immediately I'm like, oh, this is like his brand of comedy is just, it's brilliant. And I love it, but it is dark and a very, very specific type of comedy that not everyone's going to love. And we're looking at it and I'm like, you know, this would play. It's basically three scenes in three New York apartments. You know, that's what the whole piece is. So I'm like, that already kind of plays to me very sitcom-y. It's a stage thing to begin with. We should shoot this like an old, like it has kind of this old sitcom feel to the pacing and the type of comedy, almost Married with Children-ish or All in the Family is kind of very much the vibe to it. I'm like, why don't we shoot it aesthetically like that and make it this, like, go all the way with that and, you know, shoot it in a 4:3 aspect ratio. And then I was, you know, found plugins and stuff for the editing side of it that kind of gave it that degraded VHS look. You know, yeah. That is not thing to achieve these days. So yeah, we went all the way, we painted in a studio audience via with the audio track and everything, and just went all the way with
so it's that. You could fairly say it's an experimental film. It's not mainstream as much.
Yeah, no, there's we put in, you know, we took old PSAs and cut them in as commercial breaks that kind of commented on the narrative itself. You know, there's an opening title sequence. It's just whole nine yards with it being like this Sunday special television event kind of thing. So yeah, just completely out of the box. And, you know, going to even talking to festivals that I have very good relationships with the directors of, who have programmed our stuff before, me and Shawnee both, you know, we sent it to them. They're like, what the fuck is this, guys? Like, you know, we don't have a TV section. I'm like, it's not a TV section. It's a feature film. It just looks like a TV thing. Like, so, you know, even it, we knew walking into it that we were doing something that was completely out of the box.
But what was the budget?
We're gonna have a hard time.
But what was the budget?
Well, that's, you know, so yeah, exactly. Knowing that, we structured it to be a very economically produced thing. And we shot it for under 35K, it's like 32.5K.
Right. I was going to say, when I saw the trailer, I was like, this is not a $250,000 movie. If it is, no, you should be shot. So I was like, no, it has to be a lower budget. Yep. And that's okay. And real quick, I just want to hit on this. Because you're going experimental, you're going for a much smaller audience, and you know, the chances of you recouping your money are harder because of the material. You used a budget that reflected that. And most filmmakers, a lot of filmmakers don't understand. A lot of them are like, this is my opus. We're going to do this for $250,000. And you and I both know that this at a $250,000 budget is going to be rough.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you know, after doing this stuff for such a long time, man, like I read material and like the first, I can't even, you know, I also write and direct and stuff. And like, mm-hmm. I'm trying to, you know, do the creative side of it as well, but I can't, the business background in me, and then just the long amount of time I've spent producing, I know how hard it is to ask people for money. It sucks. So like, I'm trying to do that as little as possible. So like, when I'm looking for material or produce material, I'm looking like, what is the producibility of this? Like, you know, and reading Shawnee's play, three scenes.
Oh, yeah.
People being clever in three apartments. Like, I'm like, dude, we can, you know, we did that incredibly cleverly. You know, we rented a theater in Long Island City in New York, and literally like a stage theater. We ripped out all the risers, basically created a television studio environment around the stage where the seating used to be. And then when we were done, we had to rebuild those risers and stuff and put the play space back like it was. And, you know, we were able to get that on a deal, and the owner of the theater, also an actor, we cast in the film to kind of
always
grease the wheels on the negotiations.
A good idea.
For the location fees. And, you know, we shot the thing on three iPhones, you know, which that's the funny thing about it. Like, one of the things that's kind of something that's worth talking about now, Amazon's being weird about their content right now, and they're pulling things off and stripping things down. And Love is Dead's one of the things that got ripped off. You know, and they I don't know for sure. Maybe they just think it's shitty. I don't know if it's an actual image quality thing, but like, we shot that in 4K. Like, it was a beautiful image to start with, and we ripped it down to what it looks like visually, this really degraded looking, borderline terrible image, you know, the standard definition look to it. Like, that was a creative decision, not a lack of actual quality in the underlying image. We shot it on iPhones, and the image looked beautiful. And, you know, we were able to rig the theater in a way with the lighting where we didn't have to do, you know, the setups were easy. And we did that in three day shoots. We did one day of rehearsal, one day where we shot kind of like with each episode. There were three episodes. We called them episodes, shoots, whatever you want to call them. With the episode, the cast would come in. We rehearse for a day, just me and the actors. And then the next day in the morning, we would do a little more rehearsing, shoot the opening credit, just little insert shots and stuff, give me added points and what have you. Then run it a few times for everyone. The whole crew would be there that second day for everyone to see. And then the third day, come in and just run the scene front to back into the ground with our three camera setup, you know, where we didn't have to cut. We just run the thing like a play, basically, the way a sitcom does. And we did that three times in a row with one day in between to rip the whole set down. And our poor production designer had to build a whole new apartment, you know, overnight, right, basically. So we did that whole shoot. And the last one ended up, because of a snowstorm, we did the last shoot in 2 days instead of three. On that second day, we shot the whole thing.
So out of these three movies, were all of them profitable? Did any of them break even? Or did anyone lose money?
But none of them are in the black, you know. Yeah. Okay. Oh, Astro Jane's very early in the thing. I mean, came out theatrically last year in May and hit the VOD platforms in October. So it's still very early to say, you know, especially with a $250,000 movie, how that's going to go. Catch 22, we shot for $55,000, and I'd say we're probably a third of the way there on recoupment on that, especially after the whole distributor default thing. That certainly slowed things down. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, with the self-distribution thing on Love is Dead, a long way to go up there still, you know. But we didn't actually get to the point of how we did it. I mean, you know, with that kind of thing, it was such if you're going to self-distribute, knowing what are you going to try to do with this? And like, we were so outside the box with what we created and how we created it, mm-hmm. that I think that the chief marketing tool we're using for that is the independent film community, the idea of this crazy project that we created. How did we do it? And, you know, I hit all the Film Courage and all those types of outlets that are geared towards, just as you're doing, Alex, the independent mm-hmm. filmmaker.
Exactly.
You know? So, you know, again, just knowing what it is and how to market it. And, you know, the idea is over time, do that enough and you are able to make it a viable business in the long term. You know, I mean, you're not going to with self-distribution, especially smaller projects, you're not going to have that lump sum payment like kind of
it's a trickle.
It's a trickle for sure. You know, so that's how you approach it for sure.
And can you discuss a little bit about niche marketing and event marketing? Because I know that's something that you do to get the word out on your films.
Well, niche marketing, you know, it's – Astro Jane is a good example of that. Mm-hmm. It's a film about reproductive rights. And, you know, that's one of the things I learned with Astro Jane is how much having that social justice component can make just the whole process just more enjoyable for one, because it's more it gives it more purpose mm-hmm. for you. As a mm-hmm. filmmaker, it gives you a reason other than just telling a story. And that's a really nice aspect to have for these projects. But, you know, we had companies or organizations reaching out to us just from our initial press drops about the project, like wanting
of course
to screen the film, you know, because it carried this message. And like, that was, you know, Planned Parenthood was a company we had ties to and were able to align with, and NYRA and another reproductive rights women's justice organization based out of New York that we were able to align with and do a ton of marketing with throughout the festival process and then into the actual theatrical release. And we've done events and screenings with companies or organizations like that. And you know, yeah, I mean, it's everyone wants the answer as to how to do this for their own project. And there's no answer to it. Like, it's an impossible, it's the shittiest thing to hear because, you know, we all want to have the answer, but like, you have to just do the work and figure out who's going to care about that, about what you're trying to say, whether it is just a little story or it has some sort of overarching bigger purpose and getting out into the world, you know, knowing what that is. And that goes all the way back to doing that work, market research in advance, but also you learn a lot of that going through it. Like, we didn't know that we were going to have the kind of response or the political climate that we ended up having with Astro Jane, because it was pre-election that the project started, and then mm-hmm. Trump being elected, and then, you know, women's reproductive rights coming under attack as they have was not something we planned for, but that right. cropped up. And like, I don't want to, you know, it's, I've said a million times, like, it's horrific for humanity, but it's fantastic for the film. And, you know,
I understand what you said. Yeah. It's timely. It's timely.
Yeah. Embracing that and not, you don't want to say exploiting it, but, you know, if that's the message of the film, then that, you know, it's all that money. Yes, it's good for getting it out there and our bottom line. Sure. But it also allows you to say it in a bigger way. You know what I mean? And that's a beautiful thing, you know? So just
look, it's not
accepted to that.
And, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There's films that just hit at the certain time. And they just galvanize around the time, you know, there's sure. Easy Rider. When Easy Rider showed up, it was a time for Easy Rider. You know, that was the movie of its time, and it completely shaked up Hollywood when it showed up. And it was
Dennis Hopper just making something he wanted to make. That
a little indie example.
He was not checking some marketing box and making a crazy ass movie. You know?
Well, it was the 70s, brother. That was a whole other world, and there was no niche marketing. It was just like, let's just make a movie and get high a lot, and that's what they did. They actually filmed themselves.
Have you read Easy Riders, Raging Bulls?
Of course. Of course. Yeah. I've read all those books. It's amazing to hear those stories. Now I'm going to ask you a few questions to ask all my guests, sir. What advice would you give a filmmaker trying to break into the business today?
I want to steer away from what everyone says that, you know, if you can do something else, do it. Because that is probably the best advice, but we've all heard it a million times. I've said it a few times. Don't chase things. Don't chase what other people tell you you should make. Make the shit you want to watch. There's so many reasons it benefits you. It better prepares you to make that film. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you care about the stuff that you're making because it's stuff you watch, then you're that much more equipped to tell that kind of story. It's all the more reason. Like, I should never make a faith film because I'm not going to church on Sunday. So right. I should make a movie.
It's nothing you're passionate about. Got it.
Right. Exactly. You know what I mean? So, that is probably the best advice I think I could give someone getting started is to do what you think you would want to sit in front of a screen and watch because you're going to be best equipped to do that.
What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn, whether in the film business or in life?
I'm a stubborn, strong-minded person. So learning to step out of the way and to properly delegate. Somewhat of a control freak and I want everything to go my way. You know what I mean? And learning to just step back and let go of some things, whether it be control of a project or trying to, you know, you can only control what you can control and stop trying to control the things that you can't. And that is certainly a life lesson, much more so than a film one. But it's applicable, of course.
Now, what is the biggest fear you had to overcome to make your first film?
I thought about this one. I listened to the show. I thought about this one because I wanted to be prepared. And I don't know, man. Like, we were so ignorant.
Brother.
We had no idea what to be scared of. We were absolutely carried by the desire to do it. Like, to almost wanted to say, to be able to say that we did it, you know, which is such a misguided reason to make a movie. You know, we didn't have, there was no, we weren't trying to make a movie that truly said something. It was something that we thought would be entertaining. It didn't have some sort of more important message or something. We were just trying to make a piece of entertainment and I guess prove to ourselves that we could do it. So we didn't, I don't know if we had fears because we didn't, there was no way to know, you know, I don't know.
Ignorance was bliss.
Right. Yeah. I don't know if there were any, man. I really don't.
Three of your favorite films of all time.
This is impossible too, man. I don't know. I can tell you the three filmmakers I like.
Fair enough.
I can't tell you three movies is insane, dude. That's insane to narrow it down to that. The Duplass brothers. I think they are
awesome.
Genuinely magical beings. Everything they touch is gold. Sean Baker.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Sean's amazing.
Seen Tangerine at I was at Slam Dance that year with the film when that hit, and like I don't know if I've ever watched anything where I was like,
what just happened?
It had so much. It was just so much energy with. Yeah. And again, you know, knowing I part of the reason I like these filmmakers like this is because I respect so much what they accomplish, knowing the constraints they work within, and like that I work in those constraints every day, and for them to achieve such incredible with those limitations is just so impressive to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I actually a bigger filmmaker, I guess, is my drawing a blank on his name. Seven. Fincher.
Oh, Fincher. Of course. Of course. Fincher, man. Yeah, he's on my top list as well.
Which is not the same thing, but he's everything, again, someone who just he's able to keep it on the darker side, usually, which I like, even with these bigger projects, which is such a hard thing to do.
That's why he doesn't make as many movies as he should. It's because
Exactly.
He needs to make Mindhunter and he needs $200 million to do it because he's Fincher. And that's why he should have at least another four or five movies in his filmography. But I would love to see a Fincher comedy. That would be interesting.
for sure.
Because we got a Scorsese comedy. We got a couple of Scorsese comedies.
Those really dark movies, though, man. Like, you know, Seven has kind of like him and Freeman and Pitt are.
Oh, no, there's comedic moments. There's like Fight Club is on my top it's on my top five list, of course. But is Fight Club is very funny. It's ridiculously funny, but it's that kind of humor that he does bring. Oh, he has humor. I mean, House of Cards has some amazing humor in it. But I'm talking about, I want him to do Airplane 3.
Slapstick. Yeah.
Like Naked Gun 44. I want Fincher to do Naked Gun 44. I think that would be amazing.
It seems like the easiest thing in the world to market too, just because it's so such a far cry from his work. People would go see it just as like a,
I want to see Fincher do a comedy, and I want to see Nolan do a comedy. I want to see a Nolan comedy as well. Can you imagine?
I think even less likely, but yeah.
Because Kubrick did a comedy. He did a great comedy. Yeah, Dr. Strangelove. So, you know, it's...
And that's what I often struggle with mid-70s, sometime, you know, I would even say maybe late 70s content. It's slower, it's more static, very active thing, you know. So I often struggle with older films, but Strangelove is brilliant. It's hysterical. It's amazing how far ahead of its time
Everything he made.
Particularly on the comedy front. You know?
Everything he made was so far ahead of his time. Every film we catch up. I still remember getting out, and you've probably even heard this story. I've said it a bunch of times. I came out of Eyes Wide Shut in 99, and I'm with my friends from high school, and they're like, "What'd you think?" I'm like, "I don't know, but I think I'm probably going to get it in about 10 years." And I did. It took me 10 years when I got married. And then I was like, "Oh." And then every single time I watch it, I'm like, "Oh." Every time you watch any of his films, you get another layer, and that's what great art does. Now, where can people find you and your book and everything you do?
My website, NYEH Entertainment, has everything I've ever done there. The book, Still Filmmaking the Hard Way is the name, is available on wherever human beings read books these days, iBooks, Amazon, Kobo, et cetera, Scribed. Paper. It's also available in paperback if you like clutter.
Sure.
On Amazon. But yeah, I have an excerpt on my website. It's been populated a few places. Rain Dance's blog has it, Film Shortage, but even if you don't want to buy the book, whatever, I get money's tight these days, but the excerpt is free, and it is very much on the soapbox of, we got to stop letting these companies survive on our blood. So please go.
They're parasitic. They're parasitic.
Yeah, it's parasitic for sure. But that's free. So go read that, please. And let's stop supporting that.
Absolutely. Hashtag end predatory distribution.
Hashtag fuck.
Josh, man, it's been a pleasure having you on the show, brother. Thank you for dropping the knowledge bombs on the tribe and fighting the good fight out there, man. I appreciate you doing what you do, man.
Absolutely, man. Thank you so much for having me.
I want to thank Josh for coming on the show and dropping his knowledge bombs on the tribe. If you want to get links to anything we spoke about in this episode, including how to get a hold of Still Filmmaking the Hard Way, head over to the show notes at indiefilmhustle.com/434. And if you haven't already, please head over to filmmakingpodcast.com and leave an honest review for the podcast. It really helps us out a lot. And I know you guys have noticed that we've been getting really insane guests lately, and that trend is going to continue, because my guest on Tuesday is going to blow your mind, and I want you to prepare yourselves, because it will be the record holding episode for being the longest conversation I have ever had on the show, at clocking in, I think, a little bit over 3 hours. But I promise you, it is arguably one of the best episodes I have ever recorded. I can't wait to share it with you guys. And I'll give you a little hint. He's made big movies with Johnny Depp and Denzel Washington. I'm just going to leave it at that. Thank you so much for listening, guys. As always, keep that hustle going. Keep that dream alive. Stay safe out there, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at IndieFilmHustle.com. That's IndieFilmHustle.com.